Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us, and thank you to our speakers for joining us today for this important call. My name is Leslie Dach, and I'm the founder and chair of Protect Our Care, a healthcare advocacy group formed in late 2016 to protect the Affordable Care Act and strengthen our healthcare system for all Americans. Before starting Protect Our Care, I served as senior counselor to the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services during the last years of the Obama administration and also served as the department's global Ebola coordinator. Before I hand the call over to our speakers, Senator Durbin, Senator Duckworth, and Representative Kelly, I wanted to just give a brief minute or two of introduction. We meet today on an issue, the systemic discrimination against communities of color, particularly the African American community in our healthcare system, an issue and a problem that has plagued us for far too long. Just like the issues of systemic racism in our law enforcement and justice systems, they too have plagued this country for far too long. But we also meet at a time where these issues have never been more obvious, and the urgent need to address them in real and meaningful ways never more important. Today, Protect Our Care released a new report on how our healthcare system has failed African Americans and left them particularly vulnerable to dying from the coronavirus. Years of structural racism in healthcare and housing and our economy as a whole have come together to create what should be for all of us an unacceptable reality. African Americans nationwide are being hospitalized and dying at higher rates than white Americans. The death rate for African Americans is almost four times that of whites. Because of the failures in our healthcare system and our economy, Black Americans are far more likely to suffer from chronic diseases like asthma, diabetes, and heart disease, and they are far less likely to have health insurance. Black workers are disproportionately represented in jobs on the front lines of this crisis, and therefore more likely to be exposed to the virus. Less than 20% of Black workers are able to work remotely. And more than one in six African Americans have lost their jobs since February, and half of the adult African American population was jobless by April. These are all staggering numbers. And unfortunately, the President of the United States has done nothing about this. I don't think he's uttered a single word of concern. His mismanagement of the crisis has instead made it worse. It has meant that more African Americans are getting sick, more are dying, and more African Americans are trying to support themselves and their families without a paycheck. But if you thought the president could do no more harm, think again. Because next week on June 25th, the president will file a brief in the Supreme Court to completely overturn the Affordable Care Act in the middle of this pandemic, ripping health care away from 20 million Americans when a time that 27 million have already lost their employer coverage, cutting protections for 135 million Americans with pre-existing conditions, including the over 2 million Americans who have had coronavirus, and eliminating Medicaid expansion, which of course has been a particular medical lifeline to so many Americans. The American people need to know nothing more than this one action, to know that Donald Trump doesn't truly care about them or their families. And now I'd like to introduce Senator Durbin, the Senate Democratic Whip, who's been an incredible champion and fighter for healthcare for over 20 years. He was there to help be sure we passed the ACA, and he's been there every day to keep it intact, to prevent the folks who were trying to get rid of it, and to try and make it stronger every day. Thank you, Senator Durbin, for joining us.
Leslie, thanks a lot. A friend of mine recently said this pandemic is not going to break us, but it's going to teach us what's broken in America. And the first thing that we found is the terrible disparities in health care and health outcomes when it comes to people of color. You've given the numbers. They're sobering. They're frightening to think that in America there is such a difference between the health outcomes of those who are white and those who are not. Recently, I visited zip code 60649. Congresswoman Kelly knows that zip code. It's the South Shore of Chicago. And the reason we picked it was because the University of Illinois Healthcare had set up a place for testing for the COVID virus. That choice of 60649 was because that is ground zero when it comes to the highest rate of coronavirus infection among communities of color in the city of Chicago and state of Illinois. It's the reality of life for many people every day to have these gross health disparities. And the obvious question to all of us is, what are we going to do about it? When this coronavirus has ended, and I pray that soon, will we have changed America for the better when it comes to healthcare outcomes for Black and Latinx Americans? Will we basically say to them, we are going to improve the health care that is available to you? There are things we can do that we dramatically need to do. We've talked about the Affordable Care Act. I want to tell you it's the most important vote I ever cast. The Republicans, who cannot wait to put an end to what they call Obamacare, have nothing to replace it with. And now we have a situation where millions of Americans have been diagnosed with the COVID virus. They, I guess technically, are people with pre-existing conditions. Under the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, there's a protection for them in the future when they apply for health insurance. If the Republicans have their way and eliminate it, that protection is gone. 2 million more Americans vulnerable for health care premiums they can't afford or health insurance that isn't available. That's the reality. We also realize that when it comes to taking care of people who are sick across America, it's a lot of folks who are African-American and Latinx who are doing those jobs every day and risking their own lives. The real heroes include a lot of people whose skin may not be white. We also know as well that when it comes to the work across the United States, that we have got to improve health care for everyone across the board. It is not only the humane things to do, we've learned in a public health crisis, it's essential for our survival.
Thank you, Senator Durbin, for those remarks and for all you've done to help all of America. I'd like to now turn to Senator Tammy Duckworth, who too has fought for healthcare her entire career at the Veterans Department in the House of Representatives and now in the Senate. During COVID, Senator Duckworth was one of the first senators to urge the HHS to establish the kind of diagnostic testing procedures and provide the testing that Americans need to be safe. She introduced the COVID-19 Healthcare Worker Protection Act, also helped introduce the COVID-19 Relief for Small Business Act. And quite importantly, she made sure that both introduced the bill and made sure it was passed so that veterans and their loved ones could continue to receive benefits from the GI Bill and continue that as universities move online. Every day, she has been there for her constituents, for the state of Illinois, and for Americans as a whole when it comes to equality and their health care. Senator Duckworth, thanks for joining us.
Leslie, thank you so much for having me on. Hello, everyone. I want to start off by apologizing. You may hear my 5 and my 2-year-old are in the background. I live in one of those households that is especially threatened by COVID-19. I have my 79-year-old mother who lives with me, but I also have my 2 babies, 5 and 2. So you may hear them on occasion, but it's why I feel so strongly that we need to be able to have abundant testing at low cost. So everyone who can get a test should be able to get a test. That's the only way we're going to get in front of this pandemic. And first and foremost, I do want to say how grateful I am for all of our frontline workers who are risking their lives every day to keep the rest of us safe. From the doctors in the intensive care units to the cashiers who are pulling double shifts at our grocery stores, from our nursing home attendants to the hospital janitors who are working those graveyard shifts, they're all doing the tireless, often thankless work that's keeping our country running, even in the midst of this national emergency. We'll never be able to repay them for that. I also want to say how grateful I am for the activists like those of you who are on this call today, because I know you're on the front lines too, raising your voices and demanding better from your country and from your communities. These past few weeks have reminded us of the power and the need for activism. Because of George Floyd's death, it was heartbreaking, it was a tragedy, but it was not an anomaly. I think that we can and we should do better. I think these last few months have been some of the darkest I can remember for our nation, but I do know that we will make it through this, even if we have a long road ahead of us. And that's in large part because of people who are fighting for what we know is right. You know, when I served in the military, one of my last duties that I did just before I retired was to actually give briefings on pandemic response. At the time, we were dealing with SARS and we were dealing with coronavirus. Not this particular one, but the ones coming out of really expanding in the Middle East, coming out of Saudi Arabia. You know, we don't know a lot about COVID-19, but we do know this, that the statistics in the reports that we're getting and the stories that we're hearing out of the west and south sides of Chicago are just astonishing, but they're not surprising. They're actually predictable consequences, horrifying consequences of the inequities in our healthcare, economic, and environmental protection systems that have plagued communities of color for far, far too long. This system has made it harder for too many Black Americans to have access to affordable healthcare and preventative healthcare. It's where we resulted us in us locating our most toxic industries in Black and brown communities so that our children growing up in these communities have higher rates of asthma and other environmental pollutant-causing illnesses. We have so much more to do. I know that what we've done so far is just a drop in the bucket. So as we move forward towards passing a fourth phase of funding to fight back against COVID-19, you should know that I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that our more vulnerable communities get the resources and the help and the justice that they deserve. And I know that my colleagues on this call are also leading that effort. So I'm so grateful to be able to call each and every one of you on this call as my partners in this work. Thank you again for what you're doing in our communities. And with that, I am going to turn it back over to Leslie, and then we get to hear from my good friend Robin, whom I used to sit next to in the house. We refresh them together.
That's great. thank you, Senator, and thank you so much for all you do. Congresswoman Robin Kelly serves on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, so is on the forefront of America's efforts to have an equitable and valuable healthcare system. She's also chair of the Congressional Black Caucus Health Brain Trust and co-chairs the House Democratic Policy Group. Throughout her public service, she's fought for healthcare and especially to address the Black maternal healthcare crisis, where Black women are four times more likely to die from pregnancy-related complications than white women. And during this crisis, she has been a loud and effective voice, not only to bring transparency to the issues affecting the African-American community, but to be sure they have the testing they need, but also to be sure that they have the health care they need and have the opportunity to thrive economically because of the essential work they do for this country. Thank you, Congresswoman Kelly, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and thanks to Protect Our Care for organizing this important press call. Likewise, I'd like to thank my colleagues, Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Tammy Duckworth, for their continued efforts in the Senate. Despite their pleas and the pleas of the House of Representatives, Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell continues to ignore COVID-19 and its racial disparities. Since Illinois and other states first started reporting the COVID-19 racial data, it was shocking to see the numbers of Black people dying, but not surprising because of the history of the racial disparities. I just got off of a racial disparities hearing with ENC, and the doctors said it's racism, it's not race. We need to look at the social determinants of health. To those of us who've worked on health disparities and access issues, we know that any pandemic would have a disproportionate impact on more vulnerable communities and communities, frankly, that are on the front line to essential workers. And that intersection speaks to a lot of the African-American communities. But this is America, and we're all Americans, so there shouldn't be a two-tiered system, but generations of health disparities, inequities, and a lack of access to care have actually created two Americas. And even before COVID-19, we lived in a nation where the zip code in which you are born determines how long and how well you live. Even in the Chicago area, from the south side to the north side of the city, there's a 30-year disparities in how long people would live. So COVID is just the latest in a series of health threats. But I don't want to just talk about the disparities. I do want to talk a little bit about how we fixed them. And 5 years ago now, I released the Kelly Report on Health Disparities, and it was the first congressional examination of our nation's health disparities. We've had some successes and some things we're still working on. And additionally, I've introduced a number of COVID-19 specific bills that also address health disparities, like the Community Solution to COVID-19, which I introduced with Senator Cory Booker, which would create a $1.5 billion grant program for local and grassroots organizations to conduct or expand health disparity elimination work. You know, we think that if we want to end these disparities, we need to invest the resources in the communities suffering from them and empowering those communities to build a better future. When Senator Durbin and I were at the healthcare center at the 60649 zip code, he mentioned we met community workers from the community, and we think that that's really important. The other thing I'm working on is a telehealth study, because telehealth has been used during this COVID-19 time, and we want to study whether the rules that have been relaxed should stay relaxed. But and then also, lastly, it was my bill with work with some of my other colleagues that got the racial disparities in one of the CARES Acts, even though the CDC did a poor job in developing their report. But we do have a meeting with the head of the CDC Friday to talk further to him about this. So we're hoping a better report does come out. But with that, I just want to thank everybody for joining, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Congresswoman. And I just want to thank all of our speakers, not just obviously for being here today, but for all they do every day to make America better a more just place. And with that, Whitney, why don't we turn it over to you and see if we have any questions.
Great. At this time, if you have questions for any of our speakers, please press *3 on your phone to enter our Q&A queue. Again, if you have questions for any of our speakers today, please press *3 on your phone to enter our Q&A queue. All right, our first question is going to come from Lynn Sweet at the Chicago Sun-Times. Lynn, you are live.
Thank you for taking the call, and bear with me. Another big story today is the Republicans in the Senate deciding to move on a policing bill, and I'm interested from Senators Duckworth and Durbin, what do you think made the Republicans in the Senate want to move? And then what's your prognosis on if there could be a deal?
Tammy, why don't you start?
Sorry. Yes, I was just unmuting. Lynn, well, from what I've seen of the bill, and I have not seen their whole bill, but I will tell you that there's a lot more that needs to be done with that piece of legislation before we go anywhere with it. It is mostly cosmetic, and it does not have the kind of systemic change that is truly needed if we truly want to overhaul our criminal justice system so that we get rid of the inherent, not just bias, but the inherent racism that exists in our criminal justice system across this country. If anything needs to happen is we need to take a look at what they're proposing, and it has to be more than just cosmetic surface changes.
Lynn, let me just add a couple things. First is, I think the Republicans sense the same thing that we do. There is an energy in America for change when it comes to racism and law enforcement that may have started long ago, but was certainly dramatized by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. What is happening in the streets of not just major cities, but downstate communities and all across this country is a demonstration of a demand for change. It is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily generated by younger people who have said they don't want to lead their lives in America under the shadow of racism. I think the Republicans sense that and feel that. Secondly, Senator McConnell, like all of us, can point to situations in his own home state that have become very volatile over racial disparities and racial discrimination in law enforcement. And I think they realize that each one of them has a particular challenge to face. They've come up with a bill. I agree with Senator Duckworth. It is an acknowledgement that something needs to be done, but it doesn't go nearly as far as the bill that we're supporting, the Booker-Harris bill, which I think is a comprehensive bill and is likely to be passed by the House of Representatives. I think there are over 200 co-sponsors, at 220, I think, at this moment in the House of Representatives. So it's clearly an idea whose time has come, and Senator McConnell announced today that we're going to move to this bill next week.
Thank you. I was just going to ask if Congresswoman Kelly had anything to add, and then leave you time for your follow-up.
Well, no, I concur with what my colleagues have said, and I haven't seen the bill, but I concur with their comments.
Thank you. Go ahead with your follow-up.
Is the pressure on McConnell re-election, do you think, for the senators, anything that added to his extraordinary lifting of the blockade on this issue?
I think very much so. He is seeing the numbers coming in. And although they're anecdotal at this point and just sparse in number, the numbers for the president, for example, in his reelection, are really taking a hit in the last several weeks. And many of the races that he's concerned about, either reelecting Republicans or defeating Democrats, he's seeing a real shift in the numbers as well. I think that has a lot to do with his decision to really surprise all of us by moving to this bill.
You've been part of the
campaign. Let's take our next question, Whitney.
All right. Our next question is going to come from Peter Hancock at Capital News, Illinois. Peter, you are live.
Hang on. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I didn't know if I was still muted. This is either for Senator Durbin or for the Protect Our Care host. Was wondering if you can explain what the legal strategy is that, as I understand, Congress is defending the Affordable Care Act because I guess the Justice Department isn't. What legal strategy are you using to defend the law?
Well, the case is before the Supreme Court, and they have to decide it, and we're expected to decide it before the election. At stake is whether the Affordable Care Act survives. And the Republicans, it was initiated by 15 or more Republican attorneys general across the United States, and then supported by President Trump and his Department of Justice to overturn Obamacare. Now, keep in mind, they do not have an alternative. They have no substitute. They've never introduced a bill on the floor of either the House or the Senate to replace it. So we run the real risk that if the Affordable Care is abolished by the Supreme Court, that millions of Americans will have their future health care in doubt and whether their health care is available or affordable. In terms of the theory of the case before the Supreme Court, it is a convoluted theory, which I don't believe would survive, but it has made it to this level. And so we cannot rule out the possibility that the Republicans will have their way. The net result in the middle of a national health care crisis and pandemic is that millions of Americans will be fearful of losing their health insurance. And many of the 2 million who've been diagnosed with this infection will now be in the ranks of those with pre-existing conditions at the mercy of insurance companies in the future.
That is so true. I mean, on the just to add a little bit more detail to your question on the legal issues. First, it's important, as the Senator said, to know that even though this case has reached the Supreme Court, it's done it by taking a path through hand-picked judges with a clear political history, and that even the attorneys, conservative attorneys who brought the previous cases to the Supreme Court trying to eliminate the Affordable Care Act say that this legal theory holds no water. And it's just wrong. Also, it's very clear that both the House, and the Senate, when they when the individual mandate was removed from the law, very purposefully limited it to just that one issue, and were very clear publicly and on the floors of both chambers that they were preserving the rest of the law. So the congressional intent here is very, very clear. So both the legal theory is flawed and the intent of Congress is very clear that the rest of the law was supposed to stand. Thank you for the question. Whitney, let's keep moving.
Yep. Our final question is going to come from Durante Matthews at WMBD. Durante, you are live.
Hello there. My question actually is, once again, for Senator Durbin. It's referring back to police reform. Now, I've been to a few of the – I've been covering a few of the protests out here in Peoria, and two of the main things that seems that are being asked are, one, holding police accountable for the use of excessive force, and also repairing relationships between police and the community. My question is, how exactly, just in your opinion, would the bill proposed by the Democrats address these issues?
Well, accountability is number one, to make sure that those involved in law enforcement and law enforcement decisions are held responsible when they make the wrong decision and hurt innocent people. It goes across the board, from recruitment and training of officers who are sensitive to racial disparities that exist in our system, making certain that the Department of Justice steps in and investigates those police departments that are suspected of engaging in this kind of conduct, banning such things as the chokeholds that killed Mr. Floyd and, unfortunately, Eric Garner and others. The list is too long to try to go through all of it. Making certain that we are also have accountability when it comes to those police and their activities in court. There is a qualified immunity standard in court now, which says that basically most people in law enforcement, even if they're guilty of misconduct and negligence, cannot be held civilly liable to pay the family of the victim for the loss of life of a breadwinner, for example, in their household. We want to change that. We really believe that those who are guilty of wrongdoing should not only be looked at from a criminal point of view, but also from their civil responsibility to the families of those who lost someone.
Thank
all
you.
Right,
Whitney, is that our last caller?
Yep.
Great.
Thank you.
I just want to thank everybody on the call. If any of our speakers have a final word, the floor is yours. If not, we'll just thank you for participating and thank all those who called in with questions. Thank you, everyone.
Let Tammy get back to the kids. Sounds good.
Oh, can you hear that? Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.